Welcome to a special edition of the Marketplace Roundtable podcast featuring Jay Mintzmyer of Value Investor's Edge. Jay first began contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2011, building up a large following through his work covering shipping stocks, probably about as comprehensively as they're covered anywhere online or in print. Since 2015, Jay has run the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. The service offers intensive coverage of deep value opportunities in the shipping, energy, MLP, and industrial sectors. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's Mintzmyer, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. And now your host, Jay Mintzmyer.
Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon if you're joining us from Europe. We're hosting another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live. Today, we're hosting Danaos Corp, represented by Evangelos Chatzis, the CFO. We're recording on the morning of 8 June 2021 at about 8 a.m. pre-market. As a reminder, nothing on this call constitutes official investment advice or company guidance in any form. I have long exposure to Danaos Corp. Keep in mind this is being recorded on 8 June, so if you listen to a recording at a later date, positions may have changed. Evangelos, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jay. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. It has been a phenomenal run in the container ship sector. I know you and I talked last August, August 2020, about the sector. I think Danaos Corp stock was about $5 at the time. And then we talked again last November, I think it was October, November, and Danaos Corp was recovering, right? But it was still much lower than it was today. So it has been phenomenal run in the container ship sector, but it seems like there's still a lot to go. So we're glad to have you back.
Glad to be here.
First of all, I wanted to ask you, we'll start big picture here. I want to talk about the overall container ship sector. What is driving the strength in rates? Because it used to be, you know, people would say it was a COVID disruption. It was very temporary. But that obviously hasn't been the case. The rates are still running. So what's keeping the rates up currently? And how sustainable do you think this is? Is this going to be another couple weeks, a couple months, a couple years? What's driving this? And what are some of those risks that could bring those rates back down?
Yeah, clearly the strength in container ship rates is obviously driven by simple supply-demand fundamentals. Container ship demand remains exuberant, and of course, it exceeds available capacity. Ships are running at 100% utilization, and box rates and charter rates reach new record levels every week. The supply side is additionally strained due to significant port delays, which again translates to lower fleet productivity, if you will. And all these factors simply result in a very strong market. Now, in terms of risks that you mentioned, obviously the primary risk in this equation relates to the supply side, right? And ordering of vessels because of the euphoria that I just described. The confidence that the market fundamentals will remain strong has indeed led to an increase in new building ordering. So today, the order book stands at approximately 17 or 18% of the existing fleet, which is, of course, higher when compared to 8% at the end of last year, but it's still way lower than 50 or 60% numbers that we had seen back in 2008. So, the lack of shipyard capacity and more importantly, I'd say the hesitance of many market participants to order vessels with conventional fuel propulsion due to the uncertainty around the emissions regulatory environment, both are inhibiting factors for new orders and are keeping a lid on excessive ordering. Look, Jay, in any event, the recently ordered ships will not deliver until at least 2023. And to your question as to how long this good market is going to last, we expect that the next 2 years are going to be very lean in terms of fleet supply growth, Actually, 2022 has scheduled deliveries of around 3.5% of the world fleet, whereas, you know, all expectations on demand point to much higher numbers. The expected strong demand post-pandemic, together with continued pressure on the supply side because of emissions regulations that will actually come into effect at the beginning of 2023, on the back of which we're going to see vessels slowing down due to the cap, mandatory caps in the available engine power of the ships. We believe all these are factors that will help comfortably absorb the existing order book. So we are in for a good run.
Yeah, well, it certainly seems that way. And it sounds, you know, the order book deliveries for 2021 are very muted. 22 is even less than 21 in some ways. So we're excited about next year. I guess I share your concern about 23 and 24. But I do hope, as you mentioned, that some of the environmental regulations will come into play. And, you know, there was a rush in new build ordering, but it was mostly in February and March. There hasn't been as many recent orders, and hopefully we've reached kind of the larger size of that order book, but we'll have to see what happens. You know, what's interesting in the container ship sector is the durations that we're seeing on these contracts. It's not just 6 months or 12 months or 18 months. We're seeing, you know, several year contracts. Can you talk about a little bit about that? What sort of durations have you been seeing in the contracts you've signed? What's kind of the average length of those ship contracts?
Today, and this is different than what I would tell you 6 months ago, right? Today, you can charter vessels across all size segments for between 3 to 5 years, right? With the larger vessels being on the higher end of charter tenor, if you will. And obviously, shorter-term deals command higher rates, and there is a trade-off. There is a decision you need to make. But right now, if I can use the baby Panamaxes as sort of the benchmark, you have the Clarkson's baby Panamax index at 50,000 plus for a year. You could very well charter such vessels for 3 years at mid-40s. And if you want to go 5 years, you'd have to settle for something like 30,000 plus. So that's where we are. These tenors are available in the marketplace, and we are actively pursuing rechartering opportunities to lock in revenue at these very good rates.
Yeah, it's really phenomenal. I mean, there's obviously a discount when you look at maybe 4 or 5 years, but when you look at 3 years, the discount is very small. You know, if 10% or less. So that's pretty remarkable. You know, you have a lot of vessels at Danaos Corp that come up for renewal in Q4 of 21 and Q1 of 22, Q2 of 22. We saw a couple of those. They came, we get the broker reports, we get Clarkson's and Vessels Value and Seashore and all those. And we saw that the Charleston and the Belita were two vessels. It looked like you fixed them for 4 years and you didn't, and the charter doesn't even start until April of next year. Is that true? And is that opportunity, is that available for more vessels?
Yes. Yes, you're right. The Charleston, the Belita actually was fixed for 4.5 years, and it starts in February of next year. So that's a, sort of when we fixed her, it was like an 8 or 9 month forward fixture. And these are all charter rates in the mid-40s, right? And you also mentioned the Charleston, fixed for 4 years. There are opportunities. People are coming well in advance of charter expirations. They see the shortage of tonnage. They want to secure the assets. And as I said, we are exploring all these opportunities because it will give us the chance to lock in very high contracted revenue percentages for next year pretty soon. And it will materially improve our contract coverage even for 2023.
Yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, that was, I don't want to mess up my public math, but that was like 8 or 9 months in advance on a couple of those fixtures there. What sort of discount is it to fix? Because I think investors would love to see, you know, you fix 5 or 10 more ships in advance, but how big a discount is it? What's kind of the trade-off between doing it now and waiting for another 6 months?
You know, we evaluate each and every charter fixture opportunity on merit when it, you know, when it comes. So I don't think I can give you a catch-all single answer, right? However, our general mindset is that, you know, given the long-term charter rates that are very strong, we would tend to fix now versus waiting. One may argue that the market is going to improve further, and maybe 6 months down the road, you can get an even better rate. But, you know, we believe the rates are healthy enough at this point, and we value securing cash flow visibility, so, and strengthening our charter book. You know, in this manner, we effectively insulate the company from an eventual market correction, whenever this may come, because fixing, you know, for 3 to 5 years out, you know, gives you significant strength.
Yeah, it's very impressive when you can sign a deal today that will lock in cash flow for, I mean, not just 2022, right? It's all the way through, those two vessels are all the way through 2026. So I think that's lost on a lot of investors, you know, maybe not so much on this call today, but, you know, when you put this into a podcast later or to the broad market, a lot of folks are concerned about the rates next year or the rates in 2 years. And, you know, you look at your charter book and every time you sign one of these deals, you're locking in more and more and more forward revenue. And I know you mentioned, you know, 23, but it's actually further. I mean, it's 24, it's 25, it's part of 2026. So it's very impressive to see those. And hopefully you can do more. I know that it's probably not as common to do, you know, 8 or 9 months in advance. It's probably more common to do, what, 2 or 3 months. But the more of those you can do, I think investors will really like that. Let's pivot a little bit and talk about Zim Integrated. So you have a shareholding there. You recently participated in a secondary offering. You sold 2 million shares, it looks like, at $40, good pricing, right? I mean, your cost basis was basically zero on those shares, so that was pretty fantastic. What are the priorities with that those proceeds from those Zim share sales?
Yes, you're right. We sold almost 20% of our Zim equity holding for a net proceeds of around $76.5 million. You know, we are a shipping company and not a holding company, and so we're kind of an unnatural shareholder in Zim, as we have said time and again in the past. Our intention is to ultimately divest of our ownership, but, you know, at the same time, we're very confident in the liner market. The liner companies are doing very well, recording record profits quarter in, quarter out. So Zim also just announced a special $2 per share dividend to be paid in September. The market expects a further $6 to $7 in dividends in the Q1 of next year. So, you know, there is a rationale in place for not exiting the position too early. And in any event, we're seeking to optimize the value of our investment in Zim and can afford to be patient. So in terms of how, you know, the proceeds from such sales are going to be utilized, this goes to broader capital allocation strategy, right? Which we can get into it if you wish, because, you know, we are producing, we're monetizing non-core assets such as the Zim holding, but we're also producing a lot of free cash flow.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent pivot, Evangelos. A good point on how Zim equity plays into the overall balance sheet picture. Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. So, you know, you're not to exaggerate too much, but you're basically drowning in cash flow, right? You have the Zim bonds, you have the HMM bonds, they're getting repaid. You have Zim equity sales, you have surging free cash flow. Your leverage has you've completely refinanced the balance sheet. The leverage, in my opinion, is actually pretty low. Let's talk about capital allocation, big picture. What are some of the things you can do with that cash, and what are some of the priorities that the company is looking at?
Yes. And thanks for giving me the opportunity to address this, because I think this is important in light, as you said, of all the cash that's coming in. So, during 2020, we purchased 5 secondhand ships for $142 million. We also concluded a $40 million scrubbers investment program. And I don't need to tell you that these vessel purchases created value and were extremely well-timed. Additionally, we opportunistically repurchased over 4 million shares of our stock for a little over $31 million. And we made these repurchases at around $7 per share. And, you know, it's hard to use, it's hard to argue against that use of capital. And, of course, recently we just reinstated our dividend at a $2 per share annualized rate. So we have been really active over the last 12 months. And as you said, we've also recently concluded a transformative refinancing of the majority of our debt through the combination of a new bank debt facility, a sale and leaseback transaction, and the $300 million 7-year bond. And of course, our new bank debt facility allows for Danaos a significant cash flow to be deployed towards growth opportunities. Some people might, you know, advocate, and we've been hearing this quite a bit, for a special dividend or a high payout model. But we think that, you know, this type of approach doesn't help us create value for our shareholders over the long term. We will allocate capital going forward, and we have the dry powder to do so, but we will allocate it where we see the biggest and best opportunity. We will deploy capital to acquire secondhand tonnage or place orders for new buildings, you know, provided such deals are backed by long-term contracts and meet our return on capital threshold returns. You know, you could say that we are in a sort of luxury situation, and I guess that, you know, I could turn it around and say that the investor misperception of being cash rich at this point is a good problem to have, and it will self-correct over time. We would like to grow the dividend over time, and we aspire to do so on the back of a growing cash flow base. We're constantly evaluating every option to deploy our capital, and we will act opportunistically to maximize value creation for our shareholders. On the other hand, of course, if there are no accretive options on the table, then we will continue to deliver. This is the strategy in a nutshell.
Yeah, I think big picture that makes sense, right? It's a balance between delevering the balance sheet, between pursuing growth, between acquiring attractive assets, between returning dividends, pursuing repurchases. You know, I think there is a little bit of consternation or angst from shareholders on the recent conference call, because I know you've mentioned, and I think you mentioned on this call earlier today, that you have no desire to go out and buy new builds at this time, right? With the current conventional propulsion technologies, without a massive duration in contracts, without a strong return on equity. And I've heard you say this, I've heard John say this, that you have no desire to do new builds. But you've also mentioned a little bit of, you know, like building up some cash and looking at something around the corner in the future. Can you clarify that a little bit when you talk about new builds, what sort of vessel you would be talking about, what sort of contract you would be talking about?
Yes, and thanks for this, because, you know, emissions technologies and the whole issue around what vessel should you order is a big issue today. And, you know, we're not convinced that new buildings purchased today are going to maintain their residual value in the future, right? You know, emissions regulations are in flux, as you know. And when and if we do place new orders, we will prioritize investments in the next generation of environmentally friendly vessels. You know, as a company, we're very environmentally aware and supportive of the global decarbonization effort. You know, we believe that the environmentally responsible course of action is to maintain dry powder to invest in the next generation of vessels instead of distributing, let's say, big special dividends. You know, being at the forefront of such impact investing will ultimately be beneficial for the value of our enterprise, right? Because, you know, at some point, such vessels will command significant premiums versus the conventional propulsion alternatives. You know, I was reading in the news, and it's a very interesting recent example. Hapag-Lloyd, one of the big liners, who recently has tripled their dividend, they were heavily criticized by their shareholders during the company's AGM, because exactly they increased the dividend payouts so much instead of keeping the cash and to use it to invest in new technologies, new emissions technologies, right? Maersk, for example, has also been very vocal in supporting decarbonization. So, you know, if this is the mindset of our customers, then I think our approach will ultimately be rewarded. As you said, Q1 of this year, there has been a wave of new building orders. This has slowed down a bit. And again, it's nowhere near the amount of ships that have been ordered in past periods of equivalent market strength, right? Market participants generally are holding back exactly because of the uncertainty in technology. However, I want to be clear, we're not going to shy away from new ordering if our criteria are met. You know, charters with long charters with acceptable returns, you know, that allow us to amortize a large portion of a very expensive asset. You know, these are projects we will pursue, although, you know, we view this time period in conjunction with the strength of our balance sheet as a unique opportunity to go green, right? And we want to be at the forefront of that because we think that's the future.
So just to clarify, when you talk about new builds, because I know you mentioned that you and I talked in November, you and I talked a couple months ago, and I know John said this on the call as well, that the current new builds that you've seen in, you know, February and March of earlier this year don't qualify, right? They don't have high enough return on equity returns. They do not meet the emission standards that you're looking for. So can you clarify a little bit on that? Is it are LNG dual fuel? Is that, does that qualify under your criteria, or are you looking for something more like ammonia or hydrogen, or what sort of vessels are you referring to?
Definitely ammonia and hydrogen are, you know, zero CO2 emission alternatives, but, you know, they're not going to be available anytime soon, right, for production. So these are coming in the near future. Of course, LNG propulsion is an option, although, you know, we're not convinced it's a solution. But we would not shy away from such projects, provided we can get decent charters with proper returns that amortize the investment. Because acquiring a vessel with conventional propulsion today, for example, bears a higher risk in terms of residual value. So you need a longer charter and better returns. And the projects we've seen, some of them were speculative orders. Other projects were, you know, orders with charters that I described, but with low single digit return on investment returns. So we would never pursue such projects because we're not going to spend the money just for the sake of growing. If our criteria are met, we will, of course, deploy capital and you know, there's no reason to have the cash sitting around on the balance sheet. And if such opportunities do not present themselves, as I said before, we will continue delivering.
I think that makes sense from the perspective of, you know, a business manager and positioning yourself for the future. I think there's a concern, right, with investors that a lot of cash will be, you know, spent wildly into a raft of new builds and speculative new builds in particular, right? And I think that the focus on you know, lower emissions technology and longer term charters, you know, certainly makes sense. I think investors are just hoping, right, that they can benefit some from this massive surge in rates. And, you know, we've seen that with your dividend. You started it off at 50 cents a quarter, $2 a year. We saw that last fall with repurchases. So we've definitely seen a balanced approach here. How do repurchases play into the cards? Because repurchases are a way of growing the company, right? On a per share basis, you are significantly growing the company when you do a repurchase. How does that factor into your equation?
I mean, as you said, I mean, we have shown willingness to repurchase shares, right? Opportunistically. Last year, we spent approximately the same amount of money on share repurchases. If you compare it to what dividends we're going to pay out for the whole of 2021. And of course, in that repurchase, we bought shares from former creditors that were owned by them as a result of our 2018 refinancing. With the purchase price, as I said before, just above $7. And, you know, we don't like to take victory laps, but I think that was a very good use of capital. At this point in time, we are not considering a new share repurchase program, mainly because, you know, if you do too much of it, and we've already bought back 18% of our outstanding shares last October, and after a certain point, you start hurting liquidity, right? And, you know, we think that at this point, this is not something that, you know, we should pursue. But it's not off the table. It's something which at this point is not a priority.
Are there any other private share blocks out there? I know there was one owner in particular who had about 1 million shares in a private block. Are there any other private shares out there that you know of? Would that make maybe more of a special situation where you could repurchase those shares without impacting trading liquidity?
No stockholders that we know want to sell. All of the big unnatural holders that we had in the stock are now out of the picture. And that has helped a lot the trading profile of the stock, but at this point there aren't any other opportunities for big blocks that do not trade.
Yeah, I think it's pretty hard for somebody to look at Danaos Corp's free cash flow and 2022 and 23 and 24 charter book and so on and want to sell even at this price. So I think that certainly makes sense. But if it comes across your desk, I hope you'll be able to act on it. Look, I mean, as investors, we want to see a balanced approach of the cash. And, you know, Danaos Corp's NAV, you said in your last presentation, and I came to similar numbers independently, was around $90. I currently estimate it's closer to $100 right now with the ZIM appreciation and some of the asset appreciations. Maybe 95 to 100 would be a reasonable range. The stock's doing well. I mean, I don't think any investors are going to complain about the return of the stock, but it's only at, you know, 60, mid 60s, right? And your NAV is 95. And whether or not NAV is the right metric, I know some folks might disagree that NAV is the best metric, but let's look at enterprise value to EBITDA. Right. If you look at forward 2022 numbers, Danaos Corp trades at like 3.5 to 4 times enterprise value to EBITDA. It is a ridiculous discount. I mean, it's like, you know, almost insulting to you and John that the company trades so cheap. So what can you do to close this gap? I mean, I know you're doing your best and you've done a lot of things, but what can we do to get Danaos Corp where it deserves to trade? Because I think people would argue that it deserves to trade somewhere between NAV and somewhere between a reasonable enterprise value multiple.
We are extremely pleased, of course, with our share price performance over the last year, right? I mean, remember, our stock is up 1,000%, and this is without it being a popular message board stock. Year to date, Danaos' stock is almost up 200%, and more than 30%. Since mid-March. We obviously wish we could make the stock go straight up, but that's not how things usually work. I do agree that our stock is still undervalued, but the market has clearly begun to take into account all of the things we accomplished over the past 12 months. you know, as I said before, just 2 months ago, we consummated a very long process that saw us completely turn around our capital structure. We have reshaped the balance sheet, the buybacks, the vessel acquisitions, the dividend that has just been reinstated. You know, one could argue that the rate of increase of our intrinsic value, whether it's NAV or any other metric, as a result of the right moves by the company's management, in conjunction, of course, with favorable market conditions, it's moving faster than what investors can follow. So, you know, we believe the gap to NAV will get closed over time as more investors come to appreciate our position in the market. And, you know, these things can take time, as we all have seen with other stocks and sectors. But as long as we continue to do the right things, we think we will get there.
Yeah, I think you nailed it when you said that the value of the company and the progress by the company and, of course, the market overall has even outpaced the stock price. And look, I mean, investors on the call today and investors, you know, worldwide, hopefully, are not are very happy with how the stock has performed. I think, for me, myself, it is a 12 to 13 bagger. I mean, it's a phenomenal return, but the company and the business has appreciated, as you said, even faster. And it's just, it's interesting to see that there's just such a discount to your enterprise value to EBITDA in particular. Like I said, mid threes to 4x, so extreme discounts. Let's talk a little bit about, because you've mentioned delevering. And you've mentioned kind of maybe investing in the next cycle and a balanced approach. What sort of leverage as a target for the company? What sort of leverage on like debt to assets or debt to EBITDA would you be targeting eventually once you have like a renewed fleet and balanced approach and all that?
We have recently stated that, you know, we have a target not to exceed 3 to 4 times net debt to EBITDA through the cycle. And obviously that means that when the market is strong, as it is today, we're going to be beneath the target. And when the market is weaker, we will have headroom. And it is when the market is weaker that you can make better investments, right? And, you know, we think this strategy is prudent. Again, if there is no better way to deploy capital at this point to strengthen the company over the long term, we will have a preference towards deleveraging and prepare the company to take advantage of growth opportunities when the right time comes. I mean, not that long ago, we had a leverage ratio north of 7 times, right? And, you know how that turned out. Our goal is to have a low-risk, shock-proof capital structure through the cycle, and we've worked very hard to be in the position we are in today. And, you know, we're actually proud of what we have accomplished. You know, again, we are here for the long term, and our focus is clearly to deploy capital and use our liquidity on profitable growth, not just growth, pursuing the right opportunities at the right time. So that's our view on leverage.
Yeah, I think that's the refreshing to hear. You know, I personally sometimes like to see leverage on attractive projects, but I also, you know, remember back to 2007, 2008, and back in that time, and it wasn't just Dallas Corp, right? It was everybody. It was C-SPAN, Atlas at the time. Costa Maria was a private company, but, you know, all the container ship companies at the time, you know, had 80 or 90% leverage. They had massive new build order books. You know, 7 times, 6 times, you know, net debt to EBITDA. So it is refreshing to hear that that's not going to be the approach this time around. Keep that net debt a little bit lower and keep your options open. I think that's what a lot of investors are concerned about, is that the balance sheet we're going to lose the strength that we've acquired. And it sounds like that's not going to be the case. So that's good to hear. You know, there's been a lot of, you and I talked earlier in the call, and I think the most exciting part of, at least in my opinion, the most exciting part is talking about fixtures like the Charleston and the Belita, you know, 4 years, 4.5 years, actually, you mentioned, and they don't even start until next year. I'm sure there's a lot of other updates that have happened with the company. Is there any, you know, potential for like an updated investor presentation or something like that to share some of these updated charters? Because I think investors would be very, you know, happy to see that this progress is being made.
Yes, we typically refresh our presentation quarterly, and that is when we disclose all new charters. In fact, we're being very analytical and provide full transparency on our charter book, in our filings and our presentation. And this has been our, sort of historical practice. And, given the size of our fleet, we've had, since we last reported, we've had three fixtures, right? So a charter renewal here and there is not, let's say, material to require specific disclosure. We would like to keep with practice of, updating all our numbers on a quarterly basis. But the market and the reports out there, you can actually, see what's happening in the market and who's fixing what and at what rates.
Yeah, of course. There's a really good information accessible via broker reports and whatnot, like for the Charleston Belita, for example. Okay, well, that's good to hear that, the quarterly update will get your full charter book. And then realistically, I know it's just an estimate. This isn't official company guidance or anything like that. But how many fixtures reasonably do you think you can do between now and the next quarterly report? I mean, I know there's a lot of stuff in Q4 this year. There's a lot of stuff in Q1 and Q2 of 22. How many fixtures reasonably do you think you can do ahead of time? Is it going to be maybe just one or two like we saw, or do you think maybe we can do 5 or 10 or any sort of estimate on those ranges?
I honestly cannot give you a number or even a ballpark. I mean, we're currently negotiating three ships. We may have three more coming up within the month, but this all depends on market appetite, of course, and how eager we are to pursue or to negotiate and get better rates, right? So I cannot give you a number, but as I said before on the call, we are continuously trying to fix longer and higher, and we're not going to shy away from fixing today as long as the deal makes sense.
Certainly. I figured I'd try to ask and see what you'd say, but no, I appreciate your discretion and yeah, don't tip your hand to the counterparties on that one. We'll root for you to get the longest possible deal at the best possible rates. And so far, I mean, I think if you go back and look at the presentations and we just talked about the Charleston and Belita, I know we're hammering this one, but those rates were phenomenal. So hopefully we'll see a little bit more of stuff like that. As we sort of round out our call today, I want to kind of ask, what do you think investors are missing about the container ship market and specifically about Danaos Corp? Like, why should an investor buy your stock? Like, why not buy Atlas Corp, or why not buy Costa Moray, or why not buy Global Ship Lease? Like, why is Danaos Corp, in your opinion, the best stock to go with and big picture on the market?
Well, I would say that investors are beginning to once again appreciate the critical role that the container ship market plays in global trade, right? We should not forget that, finished goods are predominantly transported in container ships. Therefore, demand for container transportation is always going to be there. And it's not very often that our industry is in front page news, so that's certainly helpful. In general, investors may not fully appreciate the cash flows being generated, not just by Danaos, but perhaps more importantly by the liner companies. During the worst part of the pandemic, our customers, the liner companies, showed tremendous discipline, and the industry as a whole is healthier today. What's also important is that emissions regulations, which, if you remember, were front page news heading into IMO 2020 and before the start of the pandemic, will further dramatically reshape the shipping industry as a whole. In the process, in this reshaping and moving to decarbonization, there will be significant investment opportunities that we want to take advantage of. We are ahead of the curve in this regard, as we have for many years, we've been pioneering technical and digital initiatives. Danaos is a leader in our sector, uniquely positioned with one of the strongest balance sheets in the industry. After many years of hard work, the company has been brought to a point where it can take advantage of the strong market and position itself to create sustainable value for its shareholders over the shipping cycle. And that's where we see the value of what we see the value of Danaos being. We are committed to being extremely disciplined with our balance sheet and deploy capital opportunistically.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good summary of you know, your company, at least is how I understand it as well. The container ship sector is phenomenal right now. I'm actually long a basket of companies in the space, but I'm happy that Danaos is part of them, and very happy with the past year of management and really just the past. I mean, if you go back several years, you can see how you dealt with a difficult balance sheet, you dealt with a difficult environment, you avoided any sort of dilution. In fact, you did a big repurchase. So we're looking forward to the next year or two and see what that brings. And we're certainly looking forward to the update probably in August when you report Q3 earnings and see some of those new charters. So hey, thanks again, Evangelos. I appreciate you joining us this morning.
Thank you very much, Jay, for giving us the opportunity to tell our story. And I wish you a nice day.
Absolutely, you as well. This includes another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live. We just hosted Danaos Corp, CFO Evangelos Chatzis. We recorded this on the morning of 8 June 2021, about 8 a.m. Eastern Time before market is open. As a reminder, nothing on the call today constitutes investment advice or official company guidance in any form. I have long exposure to Danaos Corp. Keep in mind this is recorded on 8 June 2021, so if you're listening to this recording at a later date, make sure you look for those latest disclosures.